This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
In community forum, black male and female relationships is free and open to the public at the Shape Community Center, 3903 Alameda. Call 713-942-0365 or mbufhouston.org. That's 713-942-0365. For the full convention schedule and cost for the entire weekend, call 713-942-0365. Let's resurrect the black family.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
Hi, Jack.
Deborah Bell.
J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
Tonight we're going to be doing a wrap-up of Pride, a short wrap-up. We'll probably just do some more as weeks goes on because there's so much going on Pride. But also, we're moving forward in talking about the Q-Fest, the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Film Festival. That will be happening later, and Christian Salinas will be with us, who is the executive director. Then, Jennifer, you're going to be interviewing?
Yes, I'm going to be interviewing Julia Serrano, and she is a trans woman of many talents, prolific writer of books, articles, music, lyrics, and is a PhD in biochemistry, which in her day job.
Okay, and then, of course, in the second hour, it's the fourth Monday, so that means Queer Music Heritage, and J.D. Doyle will be featuring the work of transgendered artists.
Absolutely.
So all that's going on, but first we go to This Way Out in News Wrap.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 23rd, 2007. A crowd variously estimated at from 2,500 to 5,000 people marched with pride in downtown Jerusalem on June 21st. About 8,000 police officers provided heavy security, and several ambulances and some 200 paramedics were also on hand. The city's ultra-Orthodox Jewish sects have violently protested, and Muslim and Christian leaders have also denounced the notion of a queer pride parade in the Holy City. But Dana Olmert, the openly lesbian daughter of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, told reporters that questioning the right to hold gay pride in Jerusalem is the equivalent of asking, why give women the right to vote? Many pride marchers wore rainbow skull caps or waved rainbow flags, and some carried posters of South African freedom fighter Nelson Mandela. They cheered and sang as they paraded from Independence Park a few hundred yards along a street that passes in front of the historic King David Hotel to Liberty Bell Park. City officials forced the cancellation of a post-parade rally, citing a slowdown strike by firefighters, which meant a legally required fire truck was not available to safeguard it. A 32-year-old ultra-Orthodox man carrying what police called a homemade explosive device was arrested before the parade began. According to officials, 19 anti-queer protesters were arrested trying to approach the march, but there were no violent confrontations. Right-wing opponents filed a last-minute appeal to Israel's Supreme Court to ban the march, but the justices ruled the night before that it could go on.
The relatively peaceful late-afternoon Pride March was a welcome change from previous years. An ultra-Orthodox man stabbed three Jerusalem marchers in 2005, for which he's serving a 12-year prison term. Last year's street parade was canceled because of safety concerns, forcing Pride activists to gather at a heavily guarded, enclosed sports stadium on the edge of the city. At least 24 officers were injured and 130 protesters were arrested in the days before this year's parade as Jerusalem police battled anti-queer demonstrators. As the Pride March proceeded, dozens of ultra-Orthodox protesters held their own demonstration in another area of the city, bringing traffic to a standstill at the main entrance to Jerusalem. As in earlier actions, trash bins were set on fire and smoke and the stench of burning garbage filled the air. Jerry Levinson, a board member of Pride Organizers Jerusalem Open House, told reporters that about 60,000 LGBT people live in metropolitan Jerusalem. Perhaps we should thank the ultra-Orthodox community for giving us what we want, he said, which is visibility that will lead to a kind of acceptance of our place in this city.
In the equally ancient and religion-dominated city of Rome, LGBT people and their allies peacefully took to the streets on June 16th to dance, party, and demand their rights. Tens of thousands of people, among them sympathetic lawmakers, marched from St. Paul's Gate to the Basilica of St. John Lateran, the official seat of the Pope as Bishop of Rome, and the site of a large church-sanctioned anti-queer family rally last month. Many Pride marchers carried rainbow flags and banners condemning the Pope's outspoken opposition to queer unions. One banner read, "More freedom, less Vatican," while another read, "Love equals family." In February, the nine-party coalition government of Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi agreed to introduce legislation that would grant legal recognition to gay and lesbian and unmarried heterosexual couples. Registered couples would gain hospital visitation, property, and inheritance rights. Queer campaigners complained that the proposed civil pacts of solidarity are a watered-down version of what Prodi had promised in last year's election. But Catholic MPs, echoing Pope Benedict XVI and many of his bishops, have condemned them as a form of pseudo-marriage that will undermine traditional family life. The bill has yet to be considered in Parliament. The country is sharply divided over whether same-gender couples should be legally recognized. A recent poll found 51% opposed and 47% in favor.
Several media outlets last week, including this one, reported passage in the Colombian legislature, with President Alvaro Uribe's support, of an all-but-signed bill granting limited rights to same-gender couples. But it's now become almost signed. The measure passed in both legislative chambers and in the House of Representatives after a joint committee reconciled the different language in each version of the bill. Routine approval in the Senate was expected, but a block of conservative members who'd initially supported the bill voted against it, sending it to defeat. The reversal came after Colombia's powerful Roman Catholic Church warned supportive lawmakers that they were violating Vatican policy and could be denied the sacraments. The measure would have granted lesbi-gay couples of legal age who've lived together for more than 2 years the same health insurance, social security, and inheritance rights as heterosexual common law married couples, and would have made Colombia the first Latin American nation to extend such rights. The bill was the fifth attempt since 1999 to legally recognize same-gender couples in the South American country. Its proponents have vowed to reintroduce a similar measure in the next session of Congress.
A motion in the Australian Senate to grant access to fertility treatment and adoption rights to same-gender couples was defeated by both the left and right this week. The opposition Labour Party voted with Conservative Prime Minister John Howard's Liberal Party government to reject the measure, proposed by Green Senator Kerry Nettle by a lopsided vote of 51-8. The defeat came during the same week that the country's Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission issued a report saying that Australia's more than 20,000 same-gender couples face systematic discrimination on a daily basis. They're denied the basic financial entitlements, tax concessions, and superannuation benefits available to heterosexual couples. And the report said, "This is just a small sample of the discrimination caused by the many federal financial and work-related laws which exclude same-gender couples." It identified 58 pieces of legislation that need to be amended to eliminate such bias.
But legal recognition of queer couples now has majority support in Australia, according to new research findings also released this week. The Galaxy poll, commissioned by the progressive political movement Get Up, found that about 3 in 4 people want gay and lesbian couples to have at least the same legal rights as de facto heterosexual partners. Some 57% say that same-gender couples should be given full marriage equality, with 37% opposed. The Human Rights Commission report and the new poll results will put additional pressure on the federal government to extend at least some rights to lesbi-gay couples. GetUp Executive Director Brett Solomon asked, "Why is it that when Australians favor equal rights for same-sex couples by more than a 3-to-1 margin, neither major party will give it to them?"
The Democrat-controlled New York Assembly passed a bill opening marriage to same-gender couples this week. But the state's top Republican said he wouldn't allow it to come to a vote in the Senate. In April, New York Democrat Eliot Spitzer became the first governor in the U.S. to introduce marriage equality legislation. It was shepherded through the Assembly by Daniel O'Donnell, the openly gay brother of lesbian celebrity Rosie O'Donnell. When the voting ended, openly gay Staten Island Democrat Matthew Titone, with cell phone in hand, told the Assembly, "I have my partner here on the phone, and he just asked me to marry him." To a round of applause, "My answer, Madam Speaker, is yes," he said. that with the close of the current legislative session just days away, Majority Leader Joseph L. Bruno of the Republican-controlled Senate declared the bill dead on arrival. O'Donnell acknowledged during the assembly debate that some members would have preferred a bill granting civil unions similar to those in neighboring New Jersey. But the Manhattan Democrats said civil unions were no substitute for full marriage, telling fellow lawmakers that it will not provide equality for people like me.
And finally, as if to underscore that point, a commission created when New Jersey legalized civil unions has been told that the law is a failure. More than 1,000 lesbi-gay couples have applied for civil union licenses since the law took effect on February 19th. Last October, the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that same-gender couples must be given all the rights of marriage, but left it up to the state legislature to decide whether to call them marriages or civil unions. The legislature chose civil unions, but the bill also mandated the establishment of the Civil Unions Review Commission to report every 6 months on whether the law was meeting the requirements of the court ruling. Longtime activist Stephen Goldstein of Garden State Equality was elected vice chair of the commission. He told the 365gay.com website that his organization has had nearly 150 complaints of companies not abiding by the law, and that it's not being recognized by a growing number of companies, all with federally regulated benefit plans. The Clinton-era so-called Defense of Marriage Act allows such insurers to reject same-gender couples. Goldstein said that nearly 1 in 8 couples who've signed up for civil unions has been denied company benefits. Garden State Equality says that the civil unions law should be amended to be called marriage, something Goldstein said would force businesses to comply. A number of state lawmakers, including the Speaker of the Assembly, Democrat Joseph J. Roberts, Jr., appear to share Goldstein's concerns. It's not clear when the commission will deliver its report to the legislature, but it's generally expected to call for full marriage equality in New Jersey. Stay tuned.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 23rd, 2007. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Rick Watts.
Crazy inside, but when I'm with you, there's no place I can hide. I start to shake, my mind's in constant confusion. Reality is just a state of delusion. You got me in a bind, because I'm losing my mind. It looks like the lock. I'll be begging for more. I don't make sense. You got me laughing and hurting. If you could just see, you'd say that I was disturbing. They put me away. Go over the deep end, so I'll just jump in and let the thoughts of you creep in. You got me in a bind, because I'm losing my mind. It looks like the lock in the door. Oh, baby, I'll be begging for more.
This is J.D. Doyle, and that was Laurel. And if you were at the Pride Festival on Saturday, you had an opportunity to hear her live. This was just a little bit of her title track, Sweet Insanity.
This is Queer Voices.
Okay, the queer pride. You know, some people seem to forget that it's JLBT pride.
Including KPFT.
Yeah.
Yes, really.
I'll even go back to gay pride, and you know how long I thought to have the word lesbian in there. The gay pride festival and parade is over for this year, and so we're looking ahead to the month of September when something, well, not exactly new, but different will be in Houston, and that's Q-Fest. And we have Kristen Salinas. He is the executive director of Q-Fest, which is what?
Q-Fest is the 11th annual Houston Gay and Lesbian International Film Festival.
And now, how did it was never called Q-Fest before.
This is the first year that we've called it Q-Fest. And
how did that name change come about?
Well, there were several reasons, two mainly. The first has to do with, well, and not to step on any toes when I say this, but I perceive a generational gap that has been occurring where you have a younger generation that views being gay very differently from, say, the older generation.
And,
I kind of fit in the middle of that because I am in my 30s, and, you know, pop culture has a certain influence on youth, and they just see being gay very differently from the way that we see it or how we grew up coming to terms with being gay. And so the point of calling or renaming it Q-Fest, I mean, obviously the Q stands for queer. I think that that word has been brought back and it's been made positive. We wanted to incorporate something positive that younger people could relate to, that the older generation could certainly relate to, and try to bridge that generational gap.
I think the younger culture also has an effect on, you said the pop culture has an effect on the queer, but it works both ways.
Absolutely.
And they bring insight into different aspects of things that they're interested in just because it's their age group.
Yeah.
That it turns out affecting. I mean, a lot of the people that were involved in Queer Nation and ACT UP were the younger kids.
Yeah.
As well as some of us more seasoned veterans.
And I think to add to your point about, you know, being political, I feel that the younger generation isn't necessarily political, and I think that is a bit of a tragedy. They forget how difficult it was, and, well, how can they forget? They didn't know. But I think by being able to bridge this generational gap, we can at least try to build some sort of community. And what better way to do that than with movies in an auditorium? I feel like, you know, we always seem to get together when there's something very tragic or very difficult, but why not do it when there's something that can be fun and stimulating?
And celebrate.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the Houston Film Festival sort of started late from some of the many other cities, including Austin, including, I guess, even Fort Worth, and, of course, other big cities like San Francisco. So it sort of had a strange beginning in the fact that it was the venues that really put it on, and there wasn't that much of a central organizing system, and I guess this is sort of changing that.
Absolutely. I mean, nothing, it's not to denigrate what started before.
No, absolutely not.
10 years ago. I mean, I think that, you know, having the arts organizations actually create a festival like this says a lot about our arts organizations.
Yes.
In Houston, and more so than other cities. But there never was, and I agree with that, there never was a central core that was related to the community itself. And I think that's probably why there's been a distance for so many years with the community and the festival. The festival, our festival, hasn't necessarily grown as rapidly as,
right,
say,
right,
Miami, or even, you know, a city as bizarre as Atlanta having, you know, such a strong community. But this is how we're trying to change that. And I should add that all of those venues that were involved in the beginning, the nonprofits I'm speaking of particularly, they're still very much involved. If you go to our website, you'll see that we have founding partners, and these are the organizations that are helping to relaunch the festival as Q-Fest.
Well, Houston also doesn't have a straight film festival of merit like some of the
Thank
other
cities. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have a strong film community, and but that's not to say that there aren't people who, you know, don't love movies.
Yes.
I mean, I'm certainly,
yes,
one of those people.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I'm from here, and I've been involved in you know, the film world for, 10 years or more. So, no, I think we need to have this sort of environment, but since we are a community festival, we have to bring the community in, and I personally feel obligated to make sure that we do accommodate the broadest scope of people we can within the community and outside the community as well.
Will there be less venues this year then?
We're going to do what we did last year and continue with the one venue system because we think that, you know, being Houston people don't like to drive around so much and, you know, just keep it in one place.
Well, I think it's less confusing and also more community feel if it's in one location.
Now, you're currently finalizing what that venue will be.
That's
right. But I agree. When the festival has been at a lot of different locations and sometimes with things occurring at the same time, it was very difficult to make it to all of them. Yeah. And but one of the other things is sometimes it's like, I don't really care about seeing these films. They didn't interest me. What is the process? What exactly is a film festival? You just get a bunch of movies and show them?
Well, there are some festivals that do that, and those are festivals that aren't very good. I think you do have to have a selection process, and, you know, I come from that world of, you know, watching all of these films and really trying to pick the ones that are aesthetically important and also are a powerful reflection of the community. So they have to have, you know, they have to have a dual purpose. And part of my goal with the festival and in the programming, and I'm not quite ready to announce which films we're showing, but there have been some films that have been announced, is, you know, to build a community, I feel like you really do need to cover as many bases as possible, and that includes showing films that may be unorthodox for some people, like, why on earth are you showing that film? Well, for some people, that speaks to them.
Yeah, you know?
Like Tarnation is not mainstream, but it's
not
to
at
a lot
all,
of people.
But yeah, right. Absolutely, and that speaks to growing up in the Houston area. I happen to know Jonathan Coet, and I did know him growing up, so that does speak to people.
Yeah, and there are films that I have seen that I would not have seen otherwise that were like, oh, that's a whole different view. That's something that I didn't realize or know about. So it's very
educational.
And also,
hopefully these are films that aren't going to be, you know, on cable for probably a long time. They may not ever make it to DVD. When do we see these films?
Exactly.
So what? Are you the sole person that decides what films get shown?
I am, yeah.
He's a decider.
Whoa! We have the decider with us. And so, but filmmakers submit their work for consideration,
yes.
So it's not just like films that you go out and find. There are people that can say, I think I have something that would be good for the community to see. Here
absolutely.
It is.
There are people who do submit directly to me, and you know, I do keep up with other film festivals to see what they're showing, and just kind of keep abreast of what's happening on the festival circuit in general. I usually start at the end of January with Sundance because there are a number of films that show there, and you know, that's where it all begins. Sundance is where all the festivals go. Sundance, and they pick a lot of their titles.
And pardon me for not knowing this, but when does Sundance occur?
Sundance happens at the end of January for about 10 days or so.
So is there a time frame of eligibility for what you're selecting from?
You know, that not necessarily. I mean, there are films that
you might hear about a film from last year's film festival and say, ooh, I wish that would play here.
That's going to happen this year. There were films that we didn't get to show last year that we're going to bring back this year.
That's good. Is there any particular film that has been selected that you're excited about?
Yes, very.
And what is that?
Oh, well, let's see.
Give us something, Kristen.
I'll give you something. Our opening night film is this film called Family Hero that stars Catherine Deneuve.
Ooh, I'm there.
Yes.
You said the magic lesbian word.
Catherine Deneuve is featured in this film, and it's also, the greatest thing about this film is it was very difficult to book. It took 6 months to get a confirmation, but we're going to be the third city in the U.S. to show it.
And the title again?
It's called Family Hero.
Family Hero.
That will be our opening night film.
All right. Now, is that an American-made film? Or
it's French.
All right. Even
now,
better.
There are some people I understand in Houston who don't like to read subtitles, but come on, guys.
Or as Suzanne Anderson always calls them, ad-libs.
Oh, Lord.
I love it. One thing, I love hearing French, but to be able to understand what they're saying is helpful. In fact, I was going to go see a French movie this weekend, and I was having trouble with glasses. My glasses broke. I couldn't find glasses. I mean, and I said, I'm not going to be able to go because I'm not going to be able to read it. But I probably would have enjoyed just sitting in the dark listening to French, right?
Just watching the images.
Right. So, are all of, are there shorts like there have been in the past that are...
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned shorts. We are working with a website called iClips.com, and I do want to spell that. I-K-L-I-P-Z.com. We're going to be doing a collaboration with them. I am inviting filmmakers who've made short films under 10 minutes that are of interest to the GLBTQ community to submit their short through iClips between July 1st and August 31st. And once those shorts are submitted, between September 1st through the 14th, we will be having members of iClips vote on their favorites, and the ones that get the highest votes become part of a program that's featured both on iClips and at the festival as well.
Oh, that's exciting.
And one other additional thing to that, iClips has an advisory board that includes people like John Cameron Mitchell and Jaleen Schnabel, and their board will pick their favorite, and then that filmmaker will have the opportunity to attend the festival in September.
And will there be an opening party like in the past?
Yes, of course.
And anything planned for that yet, or still?
We're ironing out the details now, but yes, we will have a great opening night party.
So if someone wants to have their work considered, how do they submit it?
I would go directly to the website, which is q-fest.org. Go to the website and find the link to my email address, or just click on info@q-fest.org. Send an email that way. Say you're interested in submitting your film, and you'll be getting an email directly from me.
And what are the dates?
September 20th through the 24th.
Great.
20th through 24th of September.
Yes.
And how can people get involved? Are there volunteer opportunities? Are there
absolutely
other things to be done?
We are always looking for volunteers to help pre-festival and certainly during the festival as well as post-festival. So if you're interested in volunteering, please visit our website or send an email to volunteer@q-fest.org. And there's also membership opportunities as well, because as a nonprofit like KPFT, we have to raise money too.
Okay, so people can actually become a member or a supporter.
They can become a supporter of
the
festival. Yes.
And is there anything I didn't ask you about? I want to ask you, how come if it's the Houston Festival, you're based in L.A.?
Well, I've been in L.A. for 4 years, and, well, it's a difficult question, but I'll answer it as quickly as possible. I was asked to be the ED in March, and I said, you know what, I'm going to do it. I mean, I've been involved with the festival for the last 10 years, now going on 11, and it's become something of a labor of love for me, and I really want to see it succeed. I want to see it grow. I want to see it do things other festivals aren't doing. I want Houston to have a festival we're proud of.
Mm-hmm. So you're just doing the, as they say, bi-coastal, but it's the third coast in the West Coast, right?
Yes.
Okay, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you'd want to make sure people know?
Well, I want people to please visit the website, you know, send us your comments, anything, any suggestions for films that you're interested in. I mean, we want to have the community involved as much as possible. So, you know, we're here to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, Kristen Salinas, Executive Director of HUFest 2007, which will be the 11th Annual Houston Gay and Lesbian International Film Festival. Thank you so much for being with us on Queer Voices.
To put it another way, she don't approve. Now she don't want to talk about it, so you talk about the evening news. Invisible. Just a face, something you'll move through.
doesn't change, just like putting on a different pair of shoes. Invisible. They cut like a knife, invisible. No, she don't like that kind of life, invisible. That makes you invisible.
This is JD, and that was an artist, new artist, named Cynova, C-Y-N-O-V-A, whose site, by the way, is at cynova.info. Her new album's called Miracle Alley. That track was called Invisible.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, another pride has come and gone.
What kind of pride?
Well, it was a little bit different for me because I wasn't, you know, involved in the actual putting it together. I got to ride on the floats as Grand Marshals, which was wonderful and different. And it was rather interesting. I mean, certainly there was less of a crowd this year, partly because of the weather, partly because, I guess, the publicity machine wasn't there like it usually is. But what's really interesting is to see as many kids there, which I never realized, since I never really looked out at the audience so
kids
much.
Kids meaning infants, toddlers,
well,
and above.
Children, let's say children, you know.
Yeah, and but families and a real diversity of population and ages.
Yes. Yes.
Of course, a lot of people that are in the neighborhood like to come out and watch the parade. You know, they're very supportive and friendly about it. A friend of mine lives over on Hawthorne, and a lot of the folks line up right in front of her place, and she says, you know, you just know that on that date that you make arrangements to park and everything, and she enjoys that we're there over by Lanier Middle School.
Well, and it rained. It rained until the parade started.
And so, once again, we have gotten through another year without it raining on our parade.
It doesn't rain on our parade.
The festival was really quite nice, but it was kind of spread out, so you couldn't really see all there was to see unless you...
I think if there were signs in there, it would have helped out a lot more.
For someone who has been active for a long time and has been to previous festivals and things, I kind of knew what to expect to some degree, but there were, if it was somebody just coming in who'd never been to,
would not know there was a community stage.
Yeah, right. Well, and because I was in there before as they were setting up, I saw a lot of this stuff. But actually, once it opened up, they moved some of the fencing around, so you had to sort of do like this, I guess, reverse
L. I came around that way, too, and I didn't see it.
No. Yeah, well, and that's why I said I think signs would have helped it out a bit. And there, you know, the community marketplace, or whatever they call that, where all the nonprofits are.
The tent that was sponsored by Bunnings on the Bayou.
Yes.
The community tent.
Which is really great, but...
It was tucked back, and a lot of people said they never even knew it was there. So that was a real shame. What two really great things, the... tent sponsored by Walgreens, which I think is a real community supported, when a business supports the community by supporting things that the organizations are doing. Legacy, Lesbian Health Initiative, and some other groups were working together, and they had some services and information available for the community concerning health. And they also had HIV testing, and there were plenty of people there getting tested, which I think was significant. And of course, it was air conditioned. That was really nice, and a place to get out of the rain. And then the GLBT history tent.
I love the history tent.
Yeah, it was.
In fact, JD had a picture in the paper.
Coincidentally, yes.
Yes.
Well, while you were at the tent?
Well, yes.
I was
yes.
In, talking to the organizer. We were looking at some of the display, and the Chronicle photographer took our photo. So who better than me to have
that's
the picture
right.
taken
that's right.
with the organizer, you know?
But did the article say J.D. Doyle, Queer Music
no,
Heritage?
No, it didn't do that.
No.
Maybe next year.
And you know, we had a lovely article about the radio show in the Pride magazine.
Yes, well.
But it didn't say J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage.
Well, can't get everything right. Yvonne has been editing the...
At least my name was spelled right this
the
time.
The Pride magazine for a number of years has done a great job in covering that and including something I was involved in also, working for HERA, the fact that we were going out there and signing people up to do voter IDing and make sure they're registered to vote. And the Pride committee was very generous in giving us a booth right on the outside. So we were able to get people outside and inside the festival. And that was really, really great because we...
How much did you collect?
We don't know exactly because it's in a big box right now. So starting Wednesday, if anybody is interested or has extra time, you could go to HoustonERA.org and there's information there on volunteering if you want to help with data entry. And we'll be doing that for quite a while.
Now, you were about to ask me about the artists. I know. I can tell. I can see it in your eyes.
Yes, I was. Even though I asked you before
JD,
off the air.
What about the artists
Actually, I liked them. I was a little skeptical about the lead act, not because I thought they weren't talented. They are very talented, but I didn't think they had much name recognition, especially in Houston. I'm talking about Nemesis, because they are known mostly for Logo, and Logo isn't here.
They
well,
do a
Logo
program
is now
on,
here.
Yeah, but it hasn't been here.
Right.
Logo
yes.
Television.
Yes. Owned by
okay.
CBS is the queer
and
digital.
And the group does not have a CD on the street yet, or not even digitally yet, so...
Yeah. But you can hear it on their website.
You can hear it on their website, yes.
And it's...
Do you have anything else to say, Deborah?
Well, the program is Nemesis Rising, and what more about them? What did you like about them?
They were very good performers. And, you know, that's it. They sang well. They sounded, you know, they sang to tracks, of course, with that type of music. That's what you expect. They were very good. They had good stage presence, good voices. I was impressed with them.
Who else did you like?
I liked Josh Duffy, who we had on last week.
Yeah.
I was not surprised that he was very good. Mm-hmm. And he went through his set again. Good stage presence, good singer, good material. Amy Cook was on right after him. She was new to me, kind of a sort of folk. Sort of folk. I liked her quite a bit, though. I was one of the few people watching both of those artists because it was raining, so that's really a shame. I only saw a couple songs by Laurel because of the time conflict. They were on the same time, so you had to run from one stage to the other. I saw the tail end of Pride Idol. That's okay. That's a nice idea. I hope they continue that. It seems to get some crowd involvement in a way, so that was fine. And Kimberly Caldwell, I wasn't much interested in her because she's straight, but she was very good. She's talented. She worked well with the audience. She really had spirit. Good singer. She was fine. I was pleased with the entertainment.
Yeah,
right.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to see any of it, but I'm glad you did get to see it because mm-hmm. I know how much you like to promote queer music.
Well, and network with the artist.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was a little leery beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Before until he actually saw them, he wasn't so sure what the lineup, how it would rate, but that's kind of good to hear. And about the parade itself.
Well, the parade started on time, which I'm always concerned about, and I sort of helped a little bit in the background, but Craig did a fabulous job of putting it together, especially starting at the last minute. You know, I think he was basically just parade chair for like the last 30 days.
Right.
So, and it was a little bit smaller than it has been in the past. It is, you know, but I thought the parade was pretty good. I think there were some good units in there. It had some gaps, unfortunately, and I think, you know, Craig was new and the organization wasn't quite as, you know, know, there's always gaps in the parade, but this year it was a little bit more. And being on the first, on the float, on the Grand Marshal's float, along with Garnett Coleman and Maria Gonzalez and a couple of our friends, it was really interesting. Of course, you know, as I was telling Maria, they don't really care about us. They only care about the beads.
Right.
And that's okay. People were having a good time. And, you know, the mayor was in the parade. He walked in the parade. And
big advocate for walking, bicycling.
Yes, absolutely.
Alternative.
And Anise Parker walked in the parade.
And as I sort of, when I got finished being on the float, I sort of walked back in front of the review stand and got to see a lot of the parade. And when the pom-pom float came up, there was a big, big cheering for that. But, oh, I do want to back up a little bit. When the Grand Marshal's float got to the, and this is a little point of personal privilege here.
Oh, well, I guess we'll allow it.
The Grand Marshal's float got up to the reviewing stand, Ernie from Channel 8 got out into the crowd, into the parade area, and he started giving this speech about, you know, the fact that I've been around for 25 years, and he said this, I didn't say that, if it wasn't for me, there wouldn't be this big pride parade, but he handed me this little plaque, which was a whistle in a mirror, that apparently Craig did this, like, midweek. He came up with the idea. Nobody else really knew about it. I mean, it got by me, so, you know, and I was really, really taken aback, and I was just like, wow, this is really neat, and it really meant a lot to me, and I don't usually, you know, go for these type award things, but it really did.
Well, that's a unique and special award.
Yes.
It has significance.
Yes, the Whistle Award.
Jack, for a long time, was executive director of Pride Houston and was one of the founding group that formed an ongoing committee and was an active as an when we used to do it every year, a new committee, an ad hoc committee. So and he's famous for using his whistle for
starting the parade,
starting the parade, and to whistle at people to you know, get them under
control. Guys sometimes,
yeah,
too.
That's yeah. True. I was throwing shirts and there was this woman that flashed her breast wanting me to throw her a shirt, and I said, how stupid would I be, you know? But yeah, it was really great fun along the route. Because of my glasses problem, I couldn't see that far to see, you know, faces. But I was in the pom-pom delegation, which is the people opposed to moving Pride out of Montrose. July 30th, we're going to have a special program here on Queer Voices, and we're going to hear both sides of the issue and have some call-ins and things. And hopefully it will be a community decision about what happens. That remains to be seen. A lot of people were not happy with this year's parade, not because of the rain, but they just felt like that it wasn't the caliber that it has been in the past. And
well, the chandelier was back.
Yeah.
And that was neat, going underneath it. That
was
neat.
And being in the parade, I have been in the parade before, but, you know, the last 2 years I volunteered helping at the bleachers, and then in previous years I've been a volunteer. I've done everything, just about everything you can do at one point or another in that parade. And it is something, once we get past the controversy this when the vote comes up in August about where our parade will be and if it will stay in Montrose.
Well, and you know that I was trying to be neutral and look at both sides, but after being in that parade, it's like, how can we move it out of Montrose?
I don't know. People that want to be involved have an opportunity to make the parade be what they want it to be by getting involved. And so don't complain about it unless you do something to take part. And is that pretty much our post-Pride?
We could talk for hours, but
you had a quick announcement, didn't you, Deb?
Yeah, the Bayou City Performing Arts, that's the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston and Bayou City Women's Chorus, are joining together for a special Sing for the Cure. This will benefit the Houston affiliate of the Susan G. Komen Foundation for Breast Cancer. And the concert will be in October, but between now and June 30th, there is a board member who is giving 50 cents for every dollar up to $30,000 that is, if you donate, it will be matched, and therefore they'll be able to raise more money. And to find out more about that, you can go to BCP. YUCPA.org. That's Bayou City Performing Arts. And find out more about the Sing for the Cure and how you can be part of making this happen. If you mail your donation in, it has to be there by postmarked by June 30th. And I think you can also donate online on their website. Also, quick announcement, Joe Watts is doing The Loft, which is a gay pride event, and it's readings, the different people, and this is a new venture for him, and you can find out more. Joe Watts Theater, New West, at 713-522-2204.
And we have on the line now,
we have to play the song first.
Oh, that's right, we've got a song. Hang on, Julie,
song.
We've got a song.
And it was made up back in, I think, 1999. That was Julia, then Tom Serrano, who was the lead singer of the group Bite Size. The song was called Switch Hitter. I'm very pleased to turn the interview over to Jennifer Renee.
And this is Jennifer Renee, and we have on the line Julia Serrano, who is an incredible trans woman with a long list of talents and accomplishments, a prolific writer of books, articles, music, lyrics, and just happens to be, for a day job, a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biophysics. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I can always ask. Julia, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, before you get started, can I do my pun?
No. Sure. Go ahead.
Julia, we were talking about what you do before the this part of the show came along. So I said to Jennifer, where does a biophysicist sit? And the answer that I came up with is, what was it, Jennifer?
You don't do that. You've got to remember.
That's right. I have Alzheimer's. I mean, how can I remember this stuff? Let's see. Anywhere they quantum well want to. How's that?
all of you out there who didn't get that, look it up or call someone who will help you answer.
There's a double pun in there.
Welcome. Well, I was reading over your site and going through your site, and I was just amazed at how much you're doing. I mean, how do you do it all?
I sleep very little.
Well, also, one of the main things was that you have a new book coming out. It said in the information it comes out this month. How has it been received so far?
So far, it's been received very well. So I should say that I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and so just in bumping into people, I'm bumping into people all the time who've read the book, but also people know me here better than they do in other places. So, but it feels like it's going very well. This being my first book.
Julia, this is J.D. You need to tell us the title of the book and what the title means.
Sure. So the book's called Whipping Girl, and the subtitle is A Transsexual Woman on Sexism and the Scapegoating of Femininity.
Okay, what does that mean?
That's a good question. So the book is a collection of personal essays, some of which are more personal and some of which are more essayish, but most kind of mix some of my actual experiences as a person, as a trans woman, and my observations, along with a lot of different ideas that are already out there about gender and my critiques of a lot of them. And there are two main themes that run throughout the book. And so one of the themes is that a lot of the stereotypes and misconceptions that people have about trans women are very largely rooted in misogyny, perhaps even more so than transphobia alone. And so that's one of the ideas, and a lot of the essays talk about that issue. And then the other issue that I talk about in the book is femininity, because I feel that femininity has gotten a bad rap, not only in the straight mainstream world, but I think a lot of people who are feminists or who are in the queer community often have very derogatory ideas about femininity. And particularly, there are a lot of ideas out there that femininity is particularly artificial or frivolous or passive or et cetera. And so I wanted to challenge a lot of those ideas as well.
What transgendered myth do you wish to explode in that? I know you've given me the two principal things. Is there something specific you're just trying to let everybody know that's different from what is conceived or preconceived?
Well, there are a lot of different ideas that are out there that I critique. I mean, I think one of the difficult things that I've experienced as a trans woman, and I think a lot of both trans people in general and also MTF spectrum folks more specifically, experiences that not only are the way, like our own experiences and perspectives, not only are they not really reflected back to us in the mainstream world, but also I find that a lot of the activism and rhetoric of like queer activism or feminism often has very derogatory assumptions about trans women that are very similar to those in the straight mainstream. And so I challenge a lot of different ideas out there, from psychiatric ideas to media depictions of trans women to feminist and queer theory depictions of trans people. And I just kind of go down the line and just debunk as many of the myths and misconceptions about trans women that I can.
Well, as a trans woman, thank you. Because that's you're speaking my language on that, because there are so many myths that are surround who we are that have nothing to do with who we really are. And it's just as bad with anyone, even within our own GLBT community, as well as the straight community. So anything we can do to get the information out is obviously to the good. As far as quickly, so we can get a little add-in for where can you get your book?
So if you go to my website, which is juliaserrano.com, so that's juliaserrano.com, and that's all one word. If you go there, basically on the front page, there's a link that you can find out more about the book. I have excerpts and reviews and everything on my website, and I also have links to a couple different web locations that you can buy it. And then also, of course, you know, I always recommend to people that if you can go to your local independent bookstore, that's always really great, because it's really difficult to be an independent bookstore these days.
I like that you can go to your site and watch a couple of video clips of your spoken word performances.
Yeah, there's quite a bit on my website. And not only there's that, but there's also MP3s of bite-sized demand that I'm in, which you heard one of the songs at MP3 is actually up on the website, and some of my writings are up there, and I try to keep a lot of information up there so that people can kind of wander around and find stuff.
Is Bite Size still a active group?
That's a very good question.
we want to know. That's why we're asking.
Sure. So we started playing, I think we first got together around like 97, so like about 10 years ago. We started playing out mostly around 1998. And then we were basically, Right Size was my own like personal like focus of my creative outlet for until about like 2002, when I also started doing a lot more writing and spoken word. But we'd been doing it for a long time, and we definitely, we were really lucky and had a certain amount of success in that we put out a couple CDs, and we did a lot of touring up and down of the West Coast, and things went pretty well for us, but after a while, we got a little bit burned out, and so we took a break about 2 years ago, and we've played one show since then, and we're all really good friends, and we still enjoy playing with each other, and all of us have said that we're open to doing it again, but right now, you know, we're not.
So you're not, doesn't sound like you're writing new music material.
No, actually, particularly during the two-year period, we took a break, which kind of had nothing to do with the book, and then shortly after that, I basically I got the possibility of actually having the book published by Seal Press, which is this really wonderful, it's a women's-focused publishers, and they put out a lot of really amazing books over the years, and particularly as a trans woman who's also a feminist and is also critiquing a lot of ideas that are out there about trans women and feminism, that was like the perfect opportunity. And so that kind of pretty much absorbed all of my energy over the last year and a half.
Absolutely. And congratulations on that effort.
Cool, thanks.
As far as how much of the year are you do your word art at work? How many two times do you perform of any time? Or do you mix that in with doing seminars and speeches and all? Because you've got just a wide variety of outlets.
Yeah. So I mostly, like anyone else who has a day job, that's kind of a Monday to Friday, taking up most of the middle part of the day. I basically do everything else on the side. So I'll do writing. A lot of times I'll get up early in the morning and I'll write before I go into work. And then performing, most of those events are in the evening. Every now and then I'll do a workshop, or I'll do, I've done guest lectures and classes, and I've presented my writing and ideas at conferences. And so those pretty much get scattered here and there. Most of that has happened in the Bay Area, so there hasn't been travel involved. But I've also done things out of town at different universities I've performed at. And so I just kind of try to fit it into my schedule whenever I can.
How is your work received out of town compared to San Francisco, which is kind of an insulated community?
I've gotten really good response. So for the book, even though it's only been out for about a month, I've gotten a lot of really wonderful emails from people saying that the book has really resonated with their experiences, particularly with trans women, but also people who are not trans women, who are people, you know, they might be feminist-identified or queer-identified, or they might just be an ally of trans people. And so I've gotten a lot of good response from that. I'm definitely a lot more known here just because I perform a lot here, so people have the chance to kind of hear who I am. And then in other cities, because of my website and because I've written other chapbooks in the past, in particular, my last chapbook was a chapbook that challenged a lot of the ideas around trans woman exclusion policies, like, for example, the famous one at Michigan Women's Music Festival, but other ones. And so I've gotten a lot of people stumbling onto my writings that way, and I've also had more and more people in who have gender studies classes at universities use samples of my writing in their classes, which I think is just because there's so little out there. Like, for example, a piece I wrote a couple years ago that's also a chapter in the book, which is called Skirt Chasers, Why the Media Depicts the Trans Revolution in Skirts and Heels, or Lipstick and Heels. That one has been used in a lot of classes just because there's really not a lot of material out there on depictions of trans people. and particularly trans women. And so here and there, people find out about me, I think.
Yeah. Again, you've got the new book out. Why don't you give us the title again and how people can access your book, if you
sure.
would?
Yes. So, once again, the title is Whipping Girl, A Transsexual Woman on Sexism and the Scapegoating of Femininity. But if you just remember Whipping Girl, that will help you right there.
Okay.
And then you can either look for it on my website, juliaserrano.com, or you can go to your independent bookstore. And I know a lot of bookstores are carrying it right now, so definitely look for it there or look for it online.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate there's some more that I'd like to cover with you, and maybe we can have you back another time.
Yeah, sure. I'd totally be into that.
Thank you very much. This is Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
Could learn my ABCs, bring home A's instead of D's. And my mom and dad, I'd please if I had rhythm in my nursery rhymes. In the corner on a stool, I'd sit, cause I broke a rule. But I'd show them I'm no fool, cause I got rhythm in my nursery rhymes. Tra la 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 won't get me far. Lately I've been thinking, if I had a little bit of rhythm, I could be a Washington or a Lincoln. Simple Simon at the fair met a pine, and who was there? About those two guys, I don't care, cause I got rhythm in my nursery rhyme.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and this month I'm bringing you part two of an exploration of more of the music of transgendered artists, including some special interviews. Starting the show off was Alexandra Billings, an acclaimed actress and singer, and the first transsexual to play a transsexual character on television. I've got a lot more music by her, but first, my regular listeners know how I love to dig into our history and share musical obscurities. First up is Beth Elliott, who besides being a singer, is especially known for her activism in San Francisco in the early 1970s. For example, she was a co-founder of the Alice B. Toklas Lesbian and Gay Democratic Club, and on the board of directors of the California Committee for Sexual Law Reform, and a member of the Daughters of Bilitis. That group was a pioneering lesbian organization during the 1950s and 1960s, but times were changing. The lesbian community was becoming more radical. In 1973, Beth was elected as vice president of the Daughters of Bilitis. Later that year, she was outed as transsexual and hounded out of the organization by transphobic lesbian separatists. You know how they can get. I'm sharing with you a song she wrote in 1970, which you may know was before Olivia Records ever dreamed of a woman-loving woman song. The song is called Lady on the Subway, and in an email, Beth told me it was her way of getting to hear a girl group love song addressed from one woman to another. Specifically, it was inspired by one of her all-time favorites, the song Popsicles, Icicles by the Mermaids. Here's Lady on the Subway.
I don't know where you come from, I don't know your name, but whenever I see you, I get high just the same. Lady, you're lovely and I'm at wit's end. Too shy to ask if we can be friends. I ride on the subway and I see you every day. I get off at
That was Lady on the Subway, written in 1970 and recorded in 1976. In 2005, Beth Elliott finally got around to releasing a CD of music spanning her career, and appropriately called it Buried Treasures. You could hardly get more obscure than this next recording. It's a 45 RPM record that was definitely not affected by any politically correct considerations. It's from Holland from 1974, and has a picture on the record sleeve of the singer, reportedly named Roberto. Both sides of the record were written and produced by Dutch singer Wilfred de Faria. And while Google doesn't know much about him, he looks like Roberto to me. And he does not make a good-looking woman. I guess I might use a different name too if I were releasing a song called He She. Here's Roberto.
I'm a He She. I'm a He She. Yes, indeed, as a girl, the prettiest doll you've ever seen. But I paid my knees, I paid my lip, I walk high heels and I wiggle with my hip. 'Cause I'm a he, she. I'm a he, she. I'm a he, she. Everybody knows it, I'm a he, she.
Was Roberto. Okay, I'm anxious to get to my interview with Alexandra Billings, and what a delight she is. She's gotten critical acclaim as an actress on stage, on television, and as a cabaret performer, garnering her a slew of awards. But in the early 1980s, she was a successful female impersonator in the clubs in Chicago, so that's what I ask about first.
When I first started performing, I was in Chicago at a club called Club Victoria, which is now, I believe, a Gap. They've changed into a Gap store. But back then, it was on Belmont, sort of on the north side, and I performed there for about 2 years. And I then moved to La Cage, which was on Wells, I believe Wells, and which was owned by Barbara Eden, of all strange people. So she was sort of my boss for a long time, which was fantastic. I got to work for I Dream of Jeannie, which I loved. And then I sort of moved from club to club, and then I ended up at the Baton for about 4 or 5 years, something like that. And it was great. I loved doing that. I love the art of pantomime, and I really enjoyed the world and the people. I met the best friends I think I've ever had in my life at that time, and still are great friends of mine.
What was your drag name?
Sean Kay.
And where did you get that?
I got it from the I got it from the back of an album cover. I don't remember which album it was, but this is back when they were actually making albums. So this was, you know, 1922 or whatever it was. And I got it from the back of an album cover. And I remember the group actually was called Shantee, spelled with an I. So my name for a long time was Shantee. And then I saw it in print once, and it looked like Shanty. And I thought, well, I don't want to look like a house, so I'll change the I to an E. So that's what I did.
And I've read you've won a lot of contests, Miss Wisconsin, Miss New York, Miss Chicago, Illinois, Florida.
Wow, you have been doing your research. Good heavens.
I want to know how you lived in Chicago and win Miss Florida. How does that work?
Well, I did. Like you said, I won some state contests because I wanted to eventually win Miss Continental, which I never did, which is very sad, but I never sort of won that. I was sort of the eternal first runner-up in that contest. And the other big contest besides Miss Continental was Miss Florida. Now, in order to win that, every girl, actually, that's won that has been from Florida. So I thought the same thing you did. I was like, well, I can't really enter that because I'm not from Florida. But Jim Flint, who is the owner of the Baton, said, well, listen, why don't we just send in an application and, you know, see what they say. And they accepted my application. And because I think I had won four or five state titles, they allowed me to enter. And I won, which was shocking, but I won.
I've read you're the first transsexual to have played a transsexual character on television. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And could you talk about that?
Sure. The first role was on a TV movie by Disney called Romeo and Michelle Behind the Velvet Rope, which is a prequel to the Romeo and Michelle movie, you know, with Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino.
Mm-hmm.
And the writer who wrote the original Romeo and Michelle wrote this prequel, and she put a transsexual character in, and it was so funny. It was very odd because I haven't played a lot of transsexual characters in the theater. In fact, I think I've played like three, maybe two. And it was never out of, you know, choice. It just sort of happened that way. And at the time, I had been auditioning for so much television and so much film, and I'd never gotten anything. And so I was sort of tired of it, you know? I was tired of going down and auditioning and not getting anything. It was very disconcerting. So I told my agent at the time, who called me about this role, and I said, listen, I'm not going to do this because I'm not going to get it because I never get anything, and I'm tired of doing this. And she said, listen, I really want you to come down and put yourself on tape and just, it's an hour out of your day, just come down and do it. Get a blonde wig and come down and do it. So I did it, and I really think the reason I got it was because I didn't really want to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There was sort of nothing at stake for me. Because I was like, well, I'm never going to get this, so it's not going to matter, and who cares? So I'll just go down there and read, and then I'll go home and have a Coca-Cola. And I did it, and they sent the tape out to L.A., and they liked it, and they sort of flew me out here. And it was it was really an incredible experience.
Which TV role has gotten you the most attention?
You know, probably the one I did on Grey's Anatomy, I think. Only because that was, you know, that show is just huge. I mean, the show, it's, everybody in the world watches that darn thing. And I really had no idea. I mean, I knew it was huge. But like you, I don't watch a lot of television. And if I do, it's I Love Lucy. Really, that's pretty much the only thing I watch. And I really had no idea. I mean, we live in a suburb of California that is, I'm telling you, we're in the middle of horse country out here. People ride their horses to the local Denny's. I mean, it's crazy. So it's a beautiful town, but I mean, we are way out. And we were, my partner, Chris Ann, and I were at the grain and feed store. Don't ask me why, but we were at the grain and feed store. And the woman behind the counter recognized me at the grain and feed store. So, I mean, I knew something had happened when the woman sort of said, are you Alexandra Billings? And I went, oh, my God, I'm recognized in the grain and feed store. What the hell is happening?
I understand you just missed the excitement on that show involving T.R. Knight.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah. That particular incident, which was mortifying to everyone, actually happened the day after I left. So, yes, I missed it by 24 hours, thank God. They're very lucky I wasn't on the set when that happened, to be honest with you. I have a real... How do I put this? I'm a stickler for responsibility. And I'm also a true believer in consequences. It's about consequences for your actions.
But that actor went to bigotry rehab.
Yes, didn't he just? Isn't that lovely? Bigotry rehab, which I think is just terrific. And yes, he's just a whole new person now, I'm certain of it. The whole thing is so insane. It's so ridiculous. And, you know, quite frankly, there's no cure for racism. There's no cure for homophobia. There's no cure for stupidity. You know, there's no treatment that you can take for that kind of stuff. That's about how you're raised. That's about what kind of parental guidance you had. And that's about social graces. And obviously, there are some people on the planet that don't have any of those. And there's no place you can go to sort of regain your self-worth when it comes to that kind of stuff. You either have it, you know, like Rose says in Gypsy, you either got it or you ain't. And that's it.
I was going to ask you about that. Tell me about playing Mama Rose in Gypsy.
Oh, my dear. That was a dream come true, honestly. I'd like to do it again because I have a feeling I was a bit too young. I would like to do it again. I would like to do it one more time. But the experience in and of itself is just... I mean, to sing that kind of music... Every time I opened my mouth and sang, you know, you'll be swear, I mean, when the words came out of my mouth, I couldn't believe what was happening to me. So, just to sing that kind of score and to be involved in that kind of musical, which by the way, has one of the best books ever written for a musical, it was amazing. It was an amazing experience. Yeah, that was really fun. Really fun.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people of 105. Some people can thrive in gloom, living life in a living room. That's perfect for some people who don't know they're alive. That I gotta see, yet all the places I gotta play, all the things that I gotta be in. Come on, Papa, what do you say? Some people can be content playing bingo and paying rent. That's PG for some people, for some come from people to be. But some people ain't.
Of course, that was the song Some People from Gypsy. You'll find that on Alexandra's first album, which was called Being Alive, which was released in 2000.
Oh, why did you choose Being Alive as the title track?
Gee, that's a good question. Why did we choose that? I think that was a sort of committee vote. That was myself and my producer, Ralph Lampkin, who's a terrific guy, an amazing guy, and has been with me for 20-something years. The first album I did, I wanted it to be very positive. I wanted it to be, you know, uplifting. So, I think that's how we arrived. That was a long time ago. We might have just done I don't remember, really.
Oh, what? to accept doing this interview. You wrote.
Could learn my ABCs, bring home A's instead of D's, and my mom and dad I'd please if I.
You come tell me something, you say I ought to know, that he don't love me anymore and I'll have to let him go. You say you're gonna take him, but I don't think you can, cause you ain't woman enough to take my man. Women like you, they're a dime a dozen, you can buy them anywhere. For you to get to him, I'd have to move over and I'm gonna stand right here. We'll be over my dead body, so get out while you can, cause you ain't woman enough to take my man. Dig it, Steven.
Sometimes a man's caught looking at things that he don't need.
He don't say, well, he took a second look at you, but he's in love with me. Well, I don't know where that leads you, but I know where I stand, and you ain't woman enough to take my man. Women like you, they're a dime a dozen, you can buy them anywhere. For you to get to him, I have to move over and I'm gonna stand right here.
I think that's how we arrived. That was a long time ago. We might have just done Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo.
Oh,
I don't remember really.
When you accept doing this interview, you wrote that you thought your first two CDs were very difficult for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I mean, look. Let's be honest. I'm not a great singer. I'm just not. I don't have a fabulous voice. You know, I'm not Barbara Streisand, I'm not Christina Aguilera, I don't have that kind of voice. I like performing, you know, I like to sing in front of people, that I love to do. And so when I got in the studio, you know, there was sort of no one there.
No give back.
That's right, yes, that's exactly right. I was sort of singing to Ralph and the two people in the booth, you know. It was very odd, it was a very lonely experience for me. It's hard for me to do.
From your album The Story Goes On, I really love the duet you did with Steven Rader on The Grass Is Always Greener.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was fun. He's also been a really, really good friend of mine for a very long time, and when we first got the song, he said, well, I guess I'll play the housewife and you play the big star. And I said, oh, no, let's switch it because that'll be much more fun and much more interesting for both of us. So it was great because I got to come out in a big blue muumuu with a shower cap on my head and little cat's eye glasses. And he got to dress up and look fantastic. So it was really fun to do. It was really fun.
I love that, of course, he comes across as gay in the song. You can have my husband. I've had your husband.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we wanted to sort of mess with the genders. You know, I love to do that. I love to screw with people's heads so they have to listen. They listen to the song, and then a couple minutes later they go, what? What'd you say? Huh?
I'll bet your friends are all celebrities. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? You can make a pot roast. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? First you brown an onion. The public wants your autograph.
Oy, wonderful.
What's so wonderful? You raised a teenage daughter. That's wonderful. What's so wonderful? Now she's got her hoo-ha pierced off.
my brother says God is a flat-butted, crude-cutted linebacker, a macho babe hijacker, panting at the line of scrimmage. He makes God in his own image, and I don't begrudge him that. But his is a God who hates all fags, Jews, Hindus, and kids in rags. The Bible can thump like a big bass drum till every single sacred cow comes home. I know where that's at. God is wise. God is wise. God is wise. You can't get around to the other side. You can't hold it up. Shock can I? So my brother says, say what you will, and I don't really care what you do. It's your life and it's up to you. And then he blinks his eye, which is true sky blue. Puts his arm around his daughter, turns to me the two. Jumps and cheers when his team rocks. Then there's the God who with open arms is the God of the family farms. Inhabits the fields and the flowers and the barns. Smiles when the missus darns her husband's socks. God is wise. God is wise. God is wise. You can't get around to the other side. You can't hold it anywhere. Shock can't hide. So my brother says, you know that I don't like to fight, but I think I know what's wrong for what's right. Whatever some people may do or say, you can't tell me it's okay. It ain't no way to be. And there's the God who lives in every tree. She's the one who created me. Easter waking up the spring. I'm not sure to whom I should sing or from whom I should flee. God is wise. God is wise. God is wise. You can't get around to the other side. You can't hold a rhythm and you sure can't hide.
When we first got the song, he said, well, I guess I'll play the housewife and you play the big star. And I said, oh, no, no, let's switch it because that'll be much more fun and much more interesting for both of us. So it was great because I got to come out in a big blue moo-moo with a shower cap on my head and little cat's eye glasses. And he got to dress up and look fantastic. So it was really fun to do. It was really fun.
I love that, of course, he comes across as gay in the song. You can have my husband. I've had your husband.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we wanted to sort of mess with the genders. You know, I love to do that. I love to screw with people's heads so they have to listen. They listen to the song, and then a couple minutes later they go, what? What'd you say? Huh?
I'll bet your friends are all celebrities. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? You can make a pot roast. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? First you brown an onion. The public wants your autograph.
Boy, wonderful. Boy.
What's so wonderful? You raised a teenage daughter. That's wonderful. What's so wonderful? Now she's got her hoo-ha pierced off.
Teeth and a crazy walk, or a 6-foot drag queen. That's all they understand, because those are the only people that are out, that are speaking. that have a voice. So they write these characters, and they write from what they know.
I was going to comment that it seems like for many transgendered people, it's like a journey with closets at both ends.
How do you mean?
Well, when they're first starting to self-identify, they might be a man, if it's a man becoming a woman, they would be a man at work, but in their social life, they might be a woman. So they're still in the closet, part of their life. And then they transition, and then they decide, oh, I was never a man. I'm in stuff.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yes. That's right. And so, I mean, I understand how incredibly difficult the journey is and how unbelievably confusing it is. But my point is that, like you said, to go from closet to closet doesn't help anybody. It doesn't do anything.
It's got to drive the activists crazy.
Well, it drives me crazy. I don't know if I'm an activist, but it certainly drives me crazy. I get real sick and tired of it, especially when I hear some of my own community saying, well, that's not fair. You can't portray us like that. We're not like that. And I want to turn to them and go, well, then open your freaking mouth, for the love of Christ. Stop sitting in your house and knitting and complaining. I don't want to hear you. Then stand up and say something. Come out at work. Come out when you start dating somebody. Be proud of who you are. Look at the journey you've had, for Christ's sake.
Do you think there's a divide within the trans community between trans men and trans women?
Oh, isn't that an interesting question? I don't think so. I don't think so. But boy, I would hope not. But I don't think so. I think that all of us, because we fall under that umbrella that we were talking about, that sort of transgendered umbrella, we all still sort of understand what all of us are going through. You know, I think we consider each other brothers and sisters. So no, I really don't think so. I think there's more of a divide in the gay male and female population than there is with us.
Well, one thing I was thinking about is it's, in a way, a different journey for trans men and trans women. And there are, for example...
Do you think so? How do you think? Like, what do you mean?
Psychologically, I think a trans man could all of a sudden find themselves in a world where they have male privilege.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, isn't that interesting? I think you're absolutely right. I'll never forget, you know, I started transitioning very, very young. I was about 18 or 19 years old. And I lived in California for a long time when I was younger. And, you know, it's fabulous weather out here pretty much every day, with the exception of about, you know, 2 months when it rains. And so I spent most of my youth with my shirt off. And so when I started to transition, started to go on hormone therapy and one thing or another, I realized all of a sudden, and I know this sounds a bit odd, but it was sort of a metaphor for what I was in for living as a transgendered female. I realized I could no longer spend most of my time with my shirt off. I began to have to cover myself up. And what was bizarre was, as I began to transition, I began to be treated not only as if I should cover myself, but as if I couldn't do anything all of a sudden. I couldn't open my own door. I couldn't light my own cigarettes. I couldn't put on my own coat. I all of a sudden couldn't pay for meals when I was out on a date. And I wanted to turn to all these people and go, listen, I'm still the same person. I can open my own damn door. Get out of my way. So there was, like you said, there is a loss of rights, I believe, of inalienable rights that happen. And in the reverse, when you go from female to male, I would assume that's true. You're right. You actually gain power. Isn't that interesting? I never thought about that.
And I think a lot of the women, ones who become women, kind of buy into the stereotype that they're supposed to be meek and so forth.
That's exactly right. Exactly, JD, which is what perpetuates that stereotype. You're exactly right. And unfortunately, we as transgendered females buy into that. Oh, I can't do this anymore. And oh, won't you take care of me? And oh, I'm a slight, you know, little helpless creature. And yeah.
we buy into that. And we become a caricature. We become overly so. We become a living cartoon. And quite frankly, most of the women that I know don't act like that. My Chris Ann, my partner, never acts like that, ever. She's one of the most powerful women I know.
Is there any question that I should have asked?
You should have asked me what's my favorite food.
What's your
hamburgers food? And milkshakes. Hamburgers and milkshakes.
Yes, yeah, I did read that on your website, that you can eat hamburgers until the cows come home.
That's right. And when they come home, I eat them.
I haven't said how I landed this interview with Alexandra. A couple times over the years, I've interviewed Steve Shockland and Jim Brochu. They are partners and both extremely talented, having written several excellent musicals and plays, including The Last Session and The Big Voice, God or Mormon. They were in Houston for Jim's show, Zero Hour, and when I went to see that show, I talked with Steve a little and mentioned that I was doing a show on transgendered artists. He immediately mentioned Alexandra, which psyched me up because she was already on my wish list of folks I'd like to interview, and he helped make that happen. But he also told me about a song he wrote that he wants Alex to record. The song is about Billy Tipton, who was a transgendered jazz musician who had modest success in the 40s and 50s, and it was only when he died in 1989 that it was discovered that he was a woman. There's lots more to tell about Billy, and if you want more, please check out my QMA show from August of 2000, which was my first show on transgendered music. Anyway, I mentioned Steve Shockland's song to Alex, and here are her comments.
The Billy Tipton song. Yeah, isn't it? It's a beautiful song. It's a great song. We haven't had a chance to record it yet. We wanted to have it ready before we did this interview, but we couldn't get together. But, yeah, it's a terrific song. It's a beautiful song.
Yeah, I'd love to hear you do it. That'd be great.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, not a lot of people remember Billy. It's funny. He had such a fascinating life, and this song really sort of captures that. It's sort of a story song, which I love. I love songs that have sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's such a fascinating story. You know, he had such an interesting life.
Well, hopefully on a future show, I can play you Alexandra doing Steve Shockland's song about Billy Tipton. But thanks to Steve, I can share with you his demo version of it right now. And this is a Queer Music Heritage exclusive. Steve Shockland and Brilliant Masquerade.
Inside a Corpus Christi bar, bolstered by vodka and vermouth, he hitched his wagon to a star, and Texas never knew the truth. As sure as the sun sets in the sky, as sure as some secrets stay unseen, every day he lived a lie, and every night was Halloween. He took the road less traveled on, while the boulevards diverged. Billy Tipton came to life, and his old self submerged. To old Joplin Town he ran, before his dreams became undone. He became a happy man, at least in the eyes of everyone. And he swung a magic wand, nobody saw beyond his brilliant masquerade. He was Oklahoma born, he was different from the star, and no one knew the truth he kept inside his secret heart. He was a tomboy in the reeds, he was a cowboy in the range. Born into the wrong body, knew that someday he would change. Between a woman and a man, between the magic and mirage, there was a passion in the dark, there was the kiss of camouflage. He knew the jubilation jam, and nobody ever got wise to see through the secret of the sham under his beautiful disguise. And he swung a magic wand as the old piano played.
nobody saw beyond his brilliant masquerade. Nobody lifted up his lid, nobody learned his real name. His identity stayed hid until the paramedics came. They found the wound that never healed under the cloak of balderdash. The secret never was revealed until that last famous flash. Posthumous flash. And some of his dreams would not come true. His songs would not be played, but nobody could see through his brilliant masquerade. Brilliant
masquerade. This is Alexandra Billings, and you are listening to Queer Music Heritage. Yay!
In this interview, I could definitely not do justice to all that's wonderful and exciting about Alex, so please check out her website, www.alexandrabillings.com. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. And for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. For the closing act on this show, I chose a new band out of Toronto called The Clicks. I'm very impressed with their debut album, which is called Snake House. They're getting a lot of attention and have even landed a song on the TV show The L Word. So I got their lead singer, Lucas Silveira, on the phone for this quick interview. Tell me about the new album.
Snake House is a collection of songs that I ended up writing after the end of a 6.5-year long relationship. And after that time, a series of bad things happened to me, and at the same time I started coming to terms with the fact that I was transgendered, and all these experiences together, I created the album.
How did you get on the L Word?
We did a show at Toronto Pride where we came on right after Betty, who does the theme song for the L Word, and I believe that one of the members of Betty is the music supervisor, or know somebody who is the music supervisor over at the L Word, and they asked for one of our CDs, and our manager happened to be there. They gave him one, and the next thing you knew, they asked us if we wanted to have a song on. So that's how it happened.
Have you noticed the impact of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was the night it aired. Literally on MySpace, we got like so many hits and so many emails and people asking where they could buy the CD, and it really, really changed and kind of moved things really forward for us. It was just kind of like the beginning of it starting to do that. So yeah, huge, huge impact.
And from the new Various Artists compilation, L Tunes, music from and inspired by the L Word, is a bit of their song, Complicated.
Take your pain away, it's what you had to do. So fall on through to emotion. Take your pain away, your slips on through. I felt in you the commotion.
that version of the Clicks song, Complicated, is the more radio-friendly version. The one from their own album is definitely not ready for regular radio. What part does being trans have in your music?
Not much. It's just the fact that I'm trans, it just happens to be who I am, and I don't really go into this place in myself where I say I'm trans and this is the music I write. I just write from where I am inside, like my soul, not my gender. So it's just, I take everything from experiences.
Do you think it's influenced your writing?
I don't think it's influenced my writing. I think that it has allowed me to be a lot more open with who I am and how I express myself. But I think that happens in any situation that somebody comes to terms with their identity, whether it be, you know, that they're trans, gay, bi, or just with the fact that, you know, that they come out of a life experience that has changed them as a person.
You're very out as a trans person. Have you found that to be kind of a double-edged sword as far as the band getting attention?
You know, I could, you know, if I was a bitter person and the kind of person that wanted to look on the bad side of things, then I could say, yeah, it kind of sucks because every time I get into a conversation with somebody about my music, they end up asking me about the fact that I'm transgendered. But at the same time, I think being visible is extremely important, and it is, a point of interest to a lot of people. So I don't mind so much, and I think that it has not hindered me in any way so far, so I can't say that I've seen, you know, the bad side of it. And the good side of it is that, you know, I have given something for people to talk about, so it's a good thing. You know, it's not bad.
There seems to be a growing number of trans men artists. Do you feel like a mentor in that area?
Ooh, that's such an intense word, mentor. I'd like to say that if I can help anybody be okay with who they are, whether it be that they're trans or anything else, then, you know, that's a good thing. Whether I'm somebody, you know, to be looked at to represent an entire, you know, part of the population, you know, mainly trans men, I have difficulty with that just because of the fact that I don't represent everybody and everybody's different. So, but I, you know, sometimes these things can't be helped. But it, like I said, if I can help anybody, you know, be okay with who they are, I'm totally happy with that.
Is there another song on the album that you'd like to talk about that has special meaning to you?
Well, that's difficult. They all really, really do. I think one of the songs on the album that I feel really strongly about is Oh Yeah, which is the song that we have a video for. And that song in itself is just really important to me because it was written at probably the lowest point that I could probably ever go to. And, you know, when I listened to it, I found that I went down just like the song says, but then I got back up. And it's also about strength, so it's just a song about hope and redemption, and that's kind of what I hope that the album comes through as.
Oh yeah, falling down, but I can get up. Everyone in this beautiful town can get the back up. Here.
that was a bit of the song, Oh Yeah.
I'm trying not to gush in this conversation, but I
That's
think
okay.
it's a wonderful album.
Thank you.
It really is. And the voice is terrific, but not only that, the person who produced it was wise enough to let the people understand the voice.
Yes. That was Mo Berg. He was in The Pursuit of Happiness, a band that was pretty big here in Canada. Back in the 80s and 90s, or early 90s, and he was amazing. He was just such an amazing human being to work with, and really just kind of like what you said, he really serves the music and the songs, and he doesn't try to, you know, make them something they're not, and I really, really love that.
Well, there's so many rock acts that you hear it and you say, oh, well, that felt good, but I don't know what they were talking about.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important to Mo, and it is very important to me, and it's one of those things that, you know, through experience and having recorded other albums previous to this, you just kind of realize that the number one thing that people want to hear is they want to hear your voice, and they want to hear the words that you're saying, and I think that Mo really puts a lot of importance on that, and we all do as a band, so it worked out.
You can find out more about this group at www.theclicks.com. And that's spelled www.theclicks.com. And I can't tell you on regular radio where the name came from, but you could probably do some Googling and find out. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to especially thank Alexandra Billings and Lucas Sabiera of The Clicks for the wonderful interviews. And there was so much from Alex's interview that I could just not fit in the radio version of this show. So my internet listeners can hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I've got one more question for Lucas Silveira, and that was to tell me about my favorite track on their album called Cry Me a River.
Well, Mr. Justin Timberlake wrote that song, and he wrote it, well, the take that I got on it anyhow, and I think I might be pretty accurate, is that it was written about his breakup with a certain lady and the loss of trust, and I just really, really related to the lyrics, and I had been coming out of a relationship that had sort of the same situation, and upon connecting with lyrics, I usually start singing songs and playing them on my guitar, and one day I just brought it into band, and we started jamming it out, and it just sounded great. There was just something about the song itself that I felt a little bit more intense about, and, you know, since I do rock and roll, I got a chance to use it as sort of like a therapy session, so to speak.
I love that you very naturally kept the male pronouns.
Well, yeah.
And that sort of makes a statement itself.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, when, especially when we play live, if they don't know us or they've never seen us play the song or whatever, they're kind of, isn't that interesting?
You were my sun, you were my earth, but you didn't know all the ways that I loved you, no. So you took a chance, made other plans. I bet you didn't know your world would come crumbling down, no. You don't have to say what you did. From him, now there's just no chance for you and me. We'll never be, and don't make it sad about it. Only you love me. Why did you leave me all alone? You told me you love me when you call me on the phone. Girl, I refuse. You're making me confused. It's some other guy. Your bridges are burned. They say some things I've been left unsaid.
perfect honesty, and you may not have blown it. You don't have to say what you did. I already know. I found out from him. Now there's just a chance for you and me. We'll never be, and don't make it sad about it. You told me you love me. Why did you leave me all alone? You told me you love me when you call me on the phone. Oh, girl, I refuse. You're making me confused with some other guy. Your bridges are burned, and now it's your turn to cry. Damage is done, so I guess I'll be leaving. The damage is done, so I guess I'll be leaving. The damage is done, so I guess I'll be leaving. The damage is done, so I guess I'll be leaving. You don't have to say what you did. Already know, I found out from him. Now there's just no chance for you and me. We'll never be, and don't I make it sad about it? You told me you love me, why did you leave me all alone? You told me you love me when you call me on the phone. Oh, girl, I refuse. You're making me confused with some other guy. Bridges are burned, and now it's your turn to cry.
Been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Years after Stonewall, lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people are celebrating Pride Day around the globe. We're still fighting for basic human rights. We're fighting for our lives from Serbia and Lebanon to the Castro District. We'll look at AIDS organizing, Latino LGBT organizing, transgender rights, and the contribution of queer intellectuals, and much, much more. Tune in to Pacifica's LGBT special called Pride and Resistance. Check your local station's website for details.
KPFT airs the national...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.